Hi, Ryan.
Hello, Rachel.
How you doing?
Oh, I've got a bit of a sore neck from
What?
Whiplash. You know the film? I watched it recently, and so my neck...
On your own?
No, you were there, but you were too busy. You were too busy. You were too busy on your phone watching the yum yum scene from Star Trek Discovery on repeat over and over again, trying to figure out why they put that in there. Why did Star Trek Discovery put a scene in which a sexy lady flicked her hair back sexily, licked her lips erotically, and said in a breathy, husky, almost sexual voice, yum yum? I don't know, and you've done the research. You're the closest person to knowing the answer, and even you are giving me a shrug right now. But how are you overall, Rachel, other than putting yourself through a purgatory state, which, by the way, went to purgatory a little while ago? There's no Australian Babylon 5 podcast there. German one for sure, but no B5 podcast there. That's Australian.
Could be better.
Why?
Because you could have not done that to me.
It could be better because you did stuff. Oh, Rachel, could you please inform all of our listeners out there, or as we like to call them, yumlings, which is a fun fact little thing. Rachel opposed yumlings very strongly to begin with. Originally, I wanted to say the naughty listeners were yumlings and the good ones were yum yumlings. And then we just eventually settled on yumlings. It rolls off the tongue. And over time, both of us have come to accept it as just this lovely thing. There's also a moment where you and I would grit our teeth whenever anyone else would refer to us as the yum yums. But now, I'm reclaiming it. I like it. We're the yum-yums. But please tell us all, including me, what we do here on the podcast.
On this particular edition of Yum Yum Podcast, we're here to talk about Babylon 5. And we are doing that from a rewatch perspective and uniquely an Australian rewatch perspective.
We're rewatching the film Australia as well, and we're making notes.
No, I've watched that film 3 times. It's stolen enough of my life.
Did it get better on the third time?
No.
So you're saying third time wasn't the charm? So, in all actuality, we are the only Australian Babylon 5 podcast in existence. I have searched far and wide. We're the only ones on Earth, the galaxy, the universe. We're the only one in hell, the only one in another dimension, the multiverse, the only one in purgatory. There's none in purgatory either. We're the only one in all of existence. Now, everyone is on the edge of their seat going, Ryan, you haven't mentioned heaven. Surely you've been trying to get to heaven. Guys, I am trying and trying so hard to get through those pearly gates to find out if there's an Australian Babylon 5 podcast up there. But for some reason, that Peter guy, he keeps turning me away, saying I'm damned, and I have no clue as to why. He does mention it's because of this obsession with the phrase yum yum, and that goes against God's values, but I think that's poppycock. I really don't understand that at all. Just like the yum yum moment, I don't understand it. But you're right, we are here to rewatch, revisit, and review episodes of Babylon 5. And what one are we doing today? We are in season 4, we're making our way through it, we're nearing the end, and what episode is it that we are here to talk about?
Episode 19, Between the Darkness and the Light. Outnumbered but not outfought, Ivanova defies the odds, leading a smaller fleet against a waiting Earth Force Armada. A rescue force led by Garibaldi uses wit and brawn to rescue Sheridan.
Okay, well, what's the plan?
I don't have one. I mean, once we get inside, I think I can get him out. It's the getting inside that's the problem.
It's possible. We've cracked some of their access tunnels, the ones they use to bring in water, take out waste. They've also got an independent air supply in case there's an attack on the dome and air pressure's compromised.
Who in this Babylon 5 episode was radiating the ability to lick their lips, throw their hair back,
Lita
and say,
with
yum,
the
yum.
Volmon eyes?
Lita? Not just with... Well, those are kind of more shadow eyes. The Volmon eyes are white glowing, but... Yeah. You have a correct...
We know that that's because she was modified by the Volmon.
Sure, that's... Thank you. I know that, and you know that. But with what you said, there would have been some nerd out there correcting us, and we would never hear the end of it. And I love the nerds because I'm one of them as well, and I would have been correcting you too.
You just tried to.
I just did. But I successfully achieved it. Guys, I'm in the podcast, and I'm doing what you want, hopefully. Now watch me do something that you also do want, which is agree with Rachel. It's Lita Alexander. Of course it is. She did not hold back on the yum yum energy. She was bursting at the seams.
I'm a good
with
liar.
It. She's a great liar, but also, how dare you call her that? She's not. She's an honest lady, and an honest lady who says yum yum. We are following up from the interrogation episode, which is a hefty thing to do because that was such a monumental one and very offbeat for what this series does. It was very stripped back.
Very unique.
And so we are following that up, and that means this episode either has a lot to live up to or it will fall short nonetheless. But we have a rather fun introduction when it comes to Sheridan, where we are continuing with the torture, but now it has evolved and changed, and we see the interrogator.
It's
a different tactic. We see the interrogator from the end of the last episode and what his methodology is. And so what is he doing to Sheridan? What is happening here?
They're pumping him full of drugs and fucking with his mind.
It's a very fun scene. Again, fun is the word to use. It's not as dark, glooming, and overbearing as the last episode because you get to see him back in his quarters. The bowl of oranges are there. Isn't that just humorous that in his drug-addled state, he does envision the bowl of oranges being there? It wouldn't be realistic if they weren't there. Even in his mind's eye, they had to be there.
They're a permanent fixture.
When I first watched this episode back in the day...
It's like they're plastic.
It's like they're... No, they're real oranges. But when I watched this episode back in the day, just again to history and relationship a little bit... This always stuck out to me because...
The oranges
were there. No, seriously, because you know that it's not real. You know that it's still there and they're clearly fucking with you. But the attention to detail to put little props like that in the room to just keep up this sense of continuity that we, the viewer, have, I always am impressed by. They didn't need to. They could have made it far more stark and bare, and they already have it be very shadowy and dark in those quarters, so we get this sense of dread.
And it's just like, we've never seen him sitting there, so it feels really weird.
I don't think I've ever seen Franklin and him just have a conversation casually.
And not on their own.
That's what
Franklin's
I mean.
Been there when they've had the kind of conversations in the mess hall.
It's
the
always
last couple of times.
It's always been business related, though. So you know something's up because Franklin's just talking to him casually. Hey, how did you escape? Who were your contacts? Da 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 da. And you get Richard Biggs playing shitty Franklin again. Not the same type of shitty Franklin as he did
Not
in Shadow Dancing.
Not as yum yum as that Franklin.
He was ecstatic. You can tell that Biggs as a performer really was yearning to have the opportunity to play sinister.
Stretch
those muscles to play the more high energy version of Franklin because most often he is measured and level-headed.
Especially
and the doctor
now that
man.
He's sober.
Yes, now that the character is on the mend in that way. And the interrogator... image keeps flicking in and out, so we get cuts and we see Sheridan still in the interrogation room and is strapped up, and then it'll cut to Franklin's talking to him in the interrogation room, and then when they go back to the quarters, it's the interrogator and his assistant sitting there, really, really playing around with what is and isn't reality for Sheridan.
Love the editing in that.
Oh, the editing is joyous.
It really elevates it.
if there's anything to compliment about this episode, we actually don't compliment this enough, but this one to me, well, the story was okay overall. Between the Darkness and the Light has never been a favorite of mine or one I've hated either, but looking at it today, I was really noticing the precision in the editing and what they were doing in the choices of the cuts and just the ability to pace it in a certain way where, yes, I may have some issues with the script and even the direction, but it was all packaged into a nice little piece of business from the editing side. We don't talk enough about the B5 editing unless it stands out in a big way, which this doesn't have any flair or flourishes.
It's not bombastic, but that sequence wouldn't work if it wasn't edited right.
They threaten to, they have a conversation about whether or not they should bring in his father and kill Sheridan's father to get him to flip over, because the entire thing about Sheridan being tortured is they want to break his mind, body, and soul. And now they're pumping him full of drugs. They feel like they're almost there because he's giving away information about contacts and details that are very vital to the resistance. And if they bring in his father and kill him, it will only just motivate Sheridan to double down on his existing attitude of defiance. And if they threaten to kill the father and don't actually do it, again,
then they've weakened their position and they don't want to do that.
Yeah, the actor who plays that interrogator, as well as the assistant, I really enjoy how they play it so offhandedly, like they are
just... Yeah, it's just casual. Like, it's nothing serious. It's just murder. Like, what do you mean? Like, you're speaking like you have morals? We don't have those anymore. Like, we don't have the homeless. We don't have morals. It's fine. It's working out great for us.
It was more clinical or administrative feeling than the interrogator in the last episode, who came across more as a bureaucrat.
And the one who was, I have no skin in this game, man.
And I'm here to save your life.
Yeah. Whereas this one's like invested in breaking him in a very different way.
The information on the resistance we can pick up later. We have to stay focused on the goal, just to make him admit that his campaign against Earth was the result of alien influence. And to ask forgiveness. If we're going to put an end to this war, we've got to break the resistance at its heart. And the most efficient way to do that is to break him.
Because we haven't really talked about this all that often, but I think this is the time. Especially because you've had an abundance of these episodes recently come up in the discussions where there's so much packed into these episodes that you almost forget that these are the episodes these happen in because they feel so monumental. But
serialized effect as well.
But we know that they thought season 4 was going to be the end of the show, and so there's a mad rush to get all of these beats that were in the story bible and just narratively speaking. And I know some folks out there put that as a major criticism against season 4, even though I think also season 4 is considered the best of
all
B5.
Killer, no filler.
Yes, and it has pacing issues in terms of it goes very fast rather than when you hear it has pacing issues and it's, you usually think slow and plotting when it comes to television. Like if I said to you Star Trek Discovery's fourth season has pacing issues, you're not thinking, oh, it's telling the story fast. No, it's slow and plotting.
Yeah.
But here it's telling the story really fast. And I did not know about the whole cancellation blah-de-blah until much, much later, and I've never really felt the effects of season 4 going that fast. And so having to analyze it and review it and sit down and talk to you...
And pace it one episode at a time.
It is answering questions that I have had before. So in this episode, you mentioned like, oh, this happens and this happens in the same episode, and that's disorientating. And the answer that they're wrapping things up and rushing through does give me clarity to things I've been struggling with over the years. Like in this very episode, we free Sheridan, we clear Garibaldi's entire season 4 like arc, basically, where we're left with at the end of the Bester episode, you're going to be fucked for a very long time. No, we just finished it. And there's just many, many moments like that. Oh no, we're got to go free Mars. And we did it like within an episode or two. And when I've watched it in the past, it's not necessarily that I've thought, oh, they had to wrap this up so quickly. It was always more, why did they have to do it in this episode and not another episode down the line? Like, for instance, we get...
We're running out of episodes.
We get here, though, it's a nice moment, and I like it very much, and it's the thing I remember this for, but Londo is in this episode, and there's
and
a whole...
Jakar's back, and I love him, and he's amazing.
Yeah, but it is 5 minutes or so of screen time spent on them, and what they offer up is very good, but it is that type of thing where I can easily say... If you're trying to cram so much in, this is something you could have not put in, and it actually would have helped the flow of this individual episode to help expand out the other things that are here, because...
But it needs to be here so the next episode and the episode after, we know why those ships are there.
That's correct. And so there's a functionality to it. Yep. So
it has to play the long game.
I love this Londo stuff where Delenn and Linnea are now made aware of and are fully angry that he has called a meeting of the council with the League of Non-Aligned Worlds without Delenn's presence, without the Minbari presence. And they take it as hostile. It's Londo, after all. He's doing something nefarious.
Like... knowing Londo, I don't like this.
He's come a long way, hasn't he, Linnea? From the early, simple, naive days of looking at Londo as this funny guy who would take him to the strip club and they would have a kung fu fight and jolly old laughs, to now where he doesn't respect him and looks down on him and...
No trust there.
And it's not only a lack of trust...
Kind of rightfully so, though. He is a war criminal.
But it's not only... Yes, and that's it. That's a part of it. What I was going to say is Linnea doesn't just not trust him. He morally looks down at him. Like, Linnea thinks of himself as someone morally superior to Londo, because of course you would. Londo's horrible. He's been horrible and he's done awful things. And we had in... I do believe it was Dust to Dust, where Veer said to them, oh, you don't know Londo the way I know Londo. He can surprise you. And this is the payoff to that statement, because here we see Linnea and Delenn are both surprised by the goodness.
Pleasantly surprised.
Yes.
Instead of horrified surprise.
They are in awe of the fact and taken aback at the good that Londo is offering here, because he has called this meeting to have all of these alien governments team up together to throw their support behind Sheridan's fleet. And they didn't want to land there because they didn't want to see it as a conflict of interest, because many people would look at this and say that they are only doing this because...
You're just going after your boyfriend.
It's your boyfriend. It's your lover. And... we didn't want that to be clouding what we're doing here, because this is bigger than that. It is a statement in itself that these warring factions or these groups that have not agreed on anything in the past are now agreeing on this one thing, because if the humans go down, what else can go down? And the humans throughout all of this have been helping us.
The glue.
They've helped us. When we would not help each other, the Drazi would not help the Narn, the Pakmara would not help the game, and the Centauri wouldn't help anyone. And now we're taking that moment to do that. And I really love this as a beat for Londo, because...
It's an important transition. And it's one of those moments that you look back on and you wonder what could have been possible for him as emperor if he didn't have a keeper.
Or what could have been possible for him as an ambassador who gave a shit and didn't have an ego and didn't have nationalistic dreams. Because he's good at his job. That's the thing. That's why he's risen to where he has in the show in the sense of negative. He's very skilled at being a diplomat and at being a politician and playing the game. But we've seen him use it for evil and for bad and for harm. And here we get to see him flip around and just talking about the...
Use his powers for good.
To talk about the slow burn redemption of Londo Mollari, this is an important step because for a character like him that's caused such monumental amount
devastation.
Of damage to the world around him, you need those occasional bursts and moments where he causes... a great amount of good to the world around him, because here this is him using his position and making a declarative statement and throwing weight behind something for the betterment of everyone rather than making things worse. Now, you can't, and I want to know your opinion on this at least, you can't just have those things be the only tool you use to redeem a character like Londo.
Yeah, it would just feel disingenuous if it's like, oh, Morden's dead. He's a good person now. Because it wasn't Morden that made him do those things. It was his drives, his desire that Morden helped manipulate, definitely. But those existed in Londo, which is what made him a prime candidate to be manipulated by the shadows.
The redemption cannot be built just on big sweeping actions, but it also has to be the small ones. This isn't the end, and he's still going to be held accountable many times over, and he's going to make some great progress, but this type of thing he's doing in here in Between the Darkness and the Light should not be the substitute for those quieter moments that we have already gotten and we will continue to get.
The gradual bits. Like, this is a landmark moment in that arc, but it's only one part that moves that forward.
In the past, we had nothing in common, but now the humans have become the glue that holds us together.
If Sheridan's forces are defeated, then Earth will turn in upon itself. They will become isolated, or they'll turn against the rest of us.
Politically, it is very wise.
Morally, it is even wiser.
Politics and morality on the same side? That doesn't happen every day, Dylan.
Londo is cleaning up his reputation. And there's another person in the episode that has to do the same thing and clear their name and show that they are good, actually. It's Mr. Garibaldi. Mr. Garibaldi is on Mars trying to get in contact with the Resistance and free Sheridan, but nobody wants to listen to him. Nobody wants to hear what he has to say.
If they get him back to Earth, they're never going to get him back.
Oh, yes, Sheridan. Yes, yes. If they get Sheridan back to Earth, we'll never get him back. And no one's going to listen to him because of what Bester said in his evil monologue. They know what you did, and no one will ever trust you again. You're screwed on all of the sides here. What's going to happen? You're going to get a telepath that's super powerful?
Where are you going to find one of those?
As Bester taps his contract written by that telepath in his coat pocket. Yeah, he didn't think of that one, did he? But what did you think of Garibaldi?
I think he was just hoping that, you know, Franklin wouldn't step in. Because otherwise Garibaldi would be dead.
Garibaldi would be dead.
Would be dead.
Franklin and Lita get into a shootout to stop the Mars Resistance from shooting Garibaldi in the face.
Pass me the rifle.
What did you think of Garibaldi in this episode, especially in the first half, where Jerry Doyle is very much playing up a highly emotional and vulnerable side to the character, something that we have been not afforded during most of this season.
But it's just like he's opened back up again. And we don't just see that with that vulnerability when he's literally got a gun to his head and when he's having that deep scan, but you also see other parts of his personality return. And I think that that's a really important function to the somebody gulped scene.
Because he has to be funny again. And it's not only is it those aspects of his personality are freed again, but how much also is it through guilt, him playing up those to remind everyone, no, it's me, and himself, this is me, because he hasn't got to be that for a whole season. I really loved what Garibaldi was doing in the story. I really loved it. I felt for him. I felt for Franklin and Lita, and Number One was completely valid in her points as well. But it made me...
Nobody was wrong. And that's one thing that I really like about a lot of scenes like that in Babylon 5, is that no one person is wrong, but it is a matter of perspective and values informing people's actions and reactions.
I was just so glad to see these dimensions to the character, and it also reinforced how good of an actor Jerry Doyle can be in this role. I have been liking what he was doing throughout season 4 because he has been showing us these little signs of this trapped Garibaldi persona, and it's just great to also flick back to what we got for those first three seasons again.
The Garibaldi we knew for the longest time.
Even if it is him with this shaky inflection in his voice begging for Stephen to listen to him, yes, that's dramatic and serious.
It's got to count for something.
Yes, and that's serious and poignant, but I just couldn't help but be reassured that he's here again. Not only just because we know science fiction-wise that, yes, his brain is free, but it's because we get to see Jerry Doyle play that up again, because he's been so stoic throughout the season and he's been very good at playing that, but that's not what we were here for with the character. And so it's just a breath of fresh air. They have a telepath there, Lita Alexander, who's a super telepath, and she can read his mind and prove it's all true and project the truth into everyone's brains. And that's how you solve the Bester problem. And it's a great solution to the story. I agree. It is. It's just very tidy.
It's fast forward mode.
This is the repercussions of it having to wrap everything up. There's a version you imagine where there's several episodes of Garibaldi
trying to get in
and worming his way and hoping
them dealing with stuff with the human popsicles.
Yes. But Lita clears his name. Everyone agrees. Hey, Garibaldi, you're back. You're back in the club.
Yep.
And you're useful because you caught him.
Franklin trusts Lita, and Lita projects in a Number One's mind, and everybody will follow her orders. So it's all done.
Steve, we worked together for 4 years. That's got to count for something.
Yeah, I thought so.
But right now, I don't know anymore. You can't do this to me. You can't let Bester screw up my entire life and not give me a chance to fix it. I can't go out this way.
This episode has so much to put into it. And there's a trick that I like that they use, which is for multiple stories here, Garibaldi's side of it and the Ivanova side, the first half is about the planning. They know the objective. They know what hurdles are in their way. Mm-hmm. But it's about figuring out the solution. Okay, what are the steps?
Not the destination.
Yes, and then the second part of it is doing it and what hitches you come across and how you bounce off of those. Heck, both characters in those stories get injured. Vonnegut gets, you know, smashed up to bits by a piece of debris.
Crunched.
And yes, and Garibaldi gets stabbed.
Again. Well, he got shot in the back.
This is his first stabbing.
Yes, yes, but he got injured in the back. That's where my mind went.
Franklin got stabbed in the stomach, at least. So there has been, and of course, let's never forget Petrov. I think he got stabbed. He got injured a lot. Poor Petrov, Garibaldi's best friend. Remember Petrov? I sure do. They do the plan, and it is probably my one of my favorite things about the Mars Resistance story during this era of the show, because we don't get much of it after season four.
No.
They free Mars, and then we'll get more of number one. But I really like the side of it where it did come across as that gritty French Resistance, World War II, where you're crawling through the tunnels. Here's a map. We don't have much. Here's a skeleton crew. Oh, it's just one person? Yeah, it's one person. And we're all fighting for the same things, but I gotta look out for my own, so fuck you. Like, yes, I want to save Sheridan because he's gonna free Mars, but fuck Sheridan. I've got stuff to look after.
Like, I want him to succeed because he promised me something. But, like, all of this is to get Mars independence. So, of course, I'm going to look after my own people first.
Martians first.
Marsies.
Marsies first. They are led through these tunnels by this character who does have a name in the episode. I think it's Felicity. I don't know why they name her in the credits. I don't think they said it out loud. But she's this badass lady with a rifle. And we're not doing her for the spotlight, but I just wanted to shout her out because this actor takes a bit part that's there just to serve a function. And she really elevates the material and makes this a memorable moment for me when watching, because she adds some grit. She adds a little bit of humor to lines that aren't funny. She breathes life into a part that doesn't need it, but thankfully it is given it. And that actor, that actress, she has a very humorous connection to this series. She was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer in episode 3 or 4 of season 1 called Teacher's Pet, where she plays a teacher of theirs at what school is it that they go to? Sunnydale?
Yeah.
And she's a teacher of theirs, and she's actually a monster that eats the students.
Praying mantis?
Yes. She turns into She-Mantis.
Wait, that Nagrath?
She's Nagrath.
That's right. So they make it a lady praying mantis.
Yeah, She-Mantis. So in the episode, she turns into a big praying mantis that eats people. Of course, B5 fans, you know what prop it is. Buffy the Vampire Slayer's first season or so, or first several seasons, I don't know, had the same makeup company and prop department people working on both shows. Hence, if you actually look at the makeup in Buffy's earlier seasons, it does look very, very B5-y. And so they needed a big bug monster. So what prop was sitting around for the last few years? Nagrath. So they painted it up, made it look a little bit more feminine, and we got She-Mantis, because you have to put the she in front of it because Mantis already has man in it. And she was the human persona of the bug. So in B5, and this was in the same year, by the way. She did that earlier in the year. In the same year that Buffy episode came out, she's in this episode of Babylon 5. So
what beautiful serendipity.
This is the only person to ever play the human version of that bug puppet animatronic, and they actually got the star in the show that puppet was made for in the first place. Amazing. Truly amazing. If only Nograth was in the episode just to spite her. If he was in the tunnel and he caught her and he said to her, "Hey, I paid for that gun. The price was high. Give me my credits, bitch." Because now he swears. Oh, man. The reboot, if it ever comes to be, they better bring Nograth back, and he's the character that gets to drop the one major swear word of the season. Could you imagine Nograth coming back and he says cunt? That would be my dream come true. In the same weird voice that he had. I miss him so much. I want to throw this over to you. This is a question that has haunted me or made me go crazy for ages. They say that you can't fire your PPGs down here because they'll set off the detectors and you'll get swarmed. And so they don't use their PPGs until later, where it doesn't matter anymore because it's already been alerted.
They've been busted.
So it's fine. Why does that mean the Earth security people down there don't use PPGs? Because Garibaldi attacks a guy and the guy stabs him with a knife. A knife, Rachel. So my question is, why? What is this? What's going on? Do Earth officers now just, do they carry knives? Like, we've never seen any of these Earth Force officers carry knives around. Like, he had a military knife on him. Knives, Rachel, knives. Thoughts on this?
At least it was an actual knife and not a sword.
Oh, hey, Larry D'Attilio, get out of your ghost form and get ridiculed by Rachel for the title of your episode, Knives, which was the last one you wrote. Those aren't knives, those are swords. I've seen you've played knifey swordy before. But what do you think of just that choice? Because that's always been one of the most weirdly absurd things to me. I always get a big chuckle out of the fact that just the idea of these Earth Force officers not walking around with PPGs, but with knives,
The choreography suggests that he has a PPG, so I guess it just gets knocked out of his hand or something. I need a frame by frame.
We need a frame by frame, but not only just that, just Rachel, for the sake of this story.
Oh, just the fact that he has a knife?
They've never had knives.
They've never had knives.
Because in that logic, wouldn't that mean Garibaldi would have a knife on him when he is serving? Because he's security? Wouldn't that... Or is this just special evil Martian Earth Force officers have knives? I've always obsessed over the fact, because you know the reason why it happens, don't you? It's because in the script, they needed some injury to happen to give Garibaldi away so then the shit can hit the fan. And the best injury would be a knife. Stab him.
It can't be too serious, but it has to be serious enough. So, stab wound in a more discreet area, but he breaks stitches, bleeds out. Great. Done.
And so now, in four seasons, we finally get the reveal that Earth Force officers have knives. And now I just want to...
Or at least that one did.
I just want to dispel the nerds' writing. I'm not saying it's unrealistic for military officers to have knives on them. I'm not saying that. I'm saying in the context of this series, it's weird that it's happening now.
Convenient.
And it will never happen again. And it does happen because... we need to stab Garibaldi so we can stitch him up, and then the sutures break, and then he bleeds, and then they get caught. That's the reason why. That's the real reason why. Don't give me, in some book they say that Earth Force officers are born with knives in their hands. I don't want to hear that kind of crap. What did you think of the breakout, the whole plan getting into motion? There's a lot of moving parts. They have to go through certain things.
Yeah, but it was simple. Go through tunnels, bluff your way in, shoot your way out.
Still think you should stay here?
Not a chance.
Lost a lot of blood, and if there's any more fighting, I can't guarantee that these sutures are going to hold.
Well, then you're just going to have to give me my money back.
You didn't pay me any money.
That's just my luck, isn't it?
Is it too simple? Does it get to the point of they manage to break him out in such a way where it undermines the seriousness of the capture in the first place?
Yes and no, because only Garibaldi could pull this off. But it is also so quick, and it has the sort of pitfall of the tension being very traditional. It's just like, okay, they get the slight inconvenience, sort of like the pebble of inconveniences, of complications, of this is as far as I go. I'm not going in there with you. Then you have a slightly bigger pebble.
The stabbing.
Of not like getting in there in the first place, bluffing your way through to it. And then the guards. Then the like actual stuff. Like, it's just each one is just a little like incremental in building up the tension, but it is very typical of the way that they do that and the barriers that come up. Like, oh yeah, the guard questions, but not for too long.
Here's the worst line JMS has ever written, by the way. Just want to let that be known right now. The worst, clunkiest, awful line that's ever been done in the show is in that moment where the guard out loud says, "If it was anyone else but you, I wouldn't let you in. But it's you, so I can trust you." Fuck off. That's one of the... Okay, you know, I slam Star Trek Discovery so hard when writers give us shit like that, and I out loud say they're treating me like a fucking idiot, and it insults me. That's one of those moments.
Yeah,
it insulting. Insulted me. We got it through the whole plan that we had watched earlier, like, that this would be the outcome. You
Garibaldi
didn't need to say it out loud.
Garibaldi basically said that.
Yeah, he said it in a smarter way before. And just seeing Garibaldi in the uniform again says it as well, because he's the Earth Force officer Garibaldi that they all love and trust. And at this point, we look at the Earth Force uniform with disgust.
Also,
most
did
often.
Franklin pack his uniform?
Yes, he did. They had them in their backpacks. They packed them. Yeah, they were ready to go. They probably had some on the go ready. But
I'm like, did he bring that to Mars with him?
Well, your question
or
is
that somebody else's.
The biggest question is, did Garibaldi bring his with him to Mars? No, he wouldn't have. So they had some on the ready, or it's just, again, plot convenience. You know what my biggest hurdle is with this? I actually don't think it's too simple. I think you're right. It incrementally has these building blocks. But you brought up something that I think is what is holding me back, and it has always been holding me back. You said this couldn't be pulled off unless it was by anyone else other than Garibaldi. And you're correct. And that's a weakness to me in terms of tone. It's silly. The whole thing's treated like a joke for a large part of it.
It's a heist.
It's a caper, but there's never any dread, tension, or fear. And that's very disappointing, because everything around Sheridan being captured... I don't even think so, because they have so many jokes undercutting it.
No, like the actual experience of Sheridan is telling me that this is scary and serious, but his escape is not communicated in the same way.
No, not at all. When we had him being taken out at the bar and captured, that was a big moment, and you felt the weight of it, as is the same statement made with the whole entire last episode where he's being tortured. And yet, because this is a Garibaldi scheme, and Garibaldi usually has that devil may care, oh golly gee, hey, you recognize me demeanor, it undermines to me the arc that was Sheridan being captured.
Yeah.
I needed his escape to have a bit of grit. I don't need this whimsy from it. I get it because it is Garibaldi. It's in line with his character. And I know people like our friend Julio really love this about the character. And guess what? I do too. But this just...
It doesn't belong here. as much as it fits in other places. It's just tonally a bit too off. There's just a bit too much juxtaposition and clashing with the tones of what we saw Sheridan experience last episode and what we saw him experience at the start of this one, and then Garibaldi's way of coming in and the setup for the caper of let's get Sheridan.
We don't talk about this anymore because the show it looks good for the majority of the time, and I do not care about how low Babylon 5's budget was, because to me, I still believe in what I'm watching. I believe in the sets and the costumes and these characters. Everyone I know who brings up Babylon 5 very quickly goes to they had a shoestring budget and that they had to work with what they got. I rarely, if ever, bring it up because it means so little to me, that aspect, because it rarely shows, it seems, to me after a certain point. And in season 4, it looks great. But this was an episode where I just, boy, there's just something so cheap and boring to me about the set and the way they shot those scenes where they're breaking Sheridan out. It does just look like a theater production level, and not in the great dramatic way we had in the previous episode where it was just a black box theater. Here there's just, and also if you've listened to this podcast, you know I don't like episodes that have cave sets because they're very cheap and dull and awful usually episodes. This is pretty close to a cave set.
I was gonna say that.
And so I just had to...
You're prejudiced.
I'm prejudiced against caves. Put that on my tomb that will be in a cave. Because of irony.
They want deniability. Now, like I said, we're here to check on his condition. But what we're really supposed to do is give him a little walk around the block, if you get my meaning.
And if he falls down a few times...
Then we need a doc to make sure he doesn't fall too hard.
Got it. If anybody but you, well, okay, going in.
We have a sprinkle of romance.
Oh, I would even say it's more than a sprinkle, but would you say a dash is more than a sprinkle?
Yes.
Then that's what I would say. We've got a dash of romance in this episode.
Definitely more than a pinch, because we've got the little bit with Marcus and Ivanova.
A lot, actually, with them.
It's a small scene, but it's really meaningful.
Mm.
But the bigger moment that we have is I love birds.
I love birds.
I love birds. She said that there was a ceremony for this.
Yeah.
I believe that she said that there was a ceremony for like when lovers are reunited after a time apart.
I'll take your word. I'm sure Sinclair wrote it and made it a thing that
happened. They have a ceremony for everything. That's the whole fucking thing. They don't seem to go by Minbari rules. They go by human rules. And John sees Delenn at the end of the corridor, as he's been wont to do since he was captured.
He will mention this to her.
Yep. He's up front with that. He's also up front with, I'm traumatized and not ready to talk about it.
Well, he's not up front because he denies it at first and then he brings it up.
Yeah, like when she's just like, really, you're trying to pull that shit with me? It's the Minbari that don't lie.
She's half now, so she can do that.
Yep.
But this is the B5 special, which is... They're unabashedly romantic.
Oh, it's so cute. It feels so much more meaningful when they get a proper smooch.
We've been withheld it for several episodes.
They just don't do it that much. They really hold back on it.
Chaste romance. I want to just go over this, the romantic angle of Babylon 5, because it is a major running thing within this series. It's not something it shies away from.
No,
it's something it very much embraces.
Part of life.
It's part of life.
Explores.
And I usually hate romantic stuff in my science fiction television. It's usually the weakest part. It's usually the most manipulative part, the elongation of it, the haves and have, oh, will they, well, will they, love triangles and blah, 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 all that crap.
I love that that's not here.
And even if we do get it,
like,
it's done in a way where it's more substantive. And I just am so curious
for the
to
love triangle with Neon.
No, I thought you were going to say Byron. That's a romance story too. But we're talking about with our main characters of Delenn and John. Their romance, we've gone over it extensively in the show, but here they embrace, they kiss, there's this swell. I am actually swept up in it. I'm actually wanting to see this. I'm not only wanting to see it, I'm feeling stuff about it in a positive manner. Well, if this is, I point to something like Enterprise or Discovery, or even we're going through, like, we watched Farscape or Battlestar Galactica, I would roll my eyes and say, no, thank you, I don't like this. If this scene happened between... This scene did, I think, happen between Apollo and Starbuck in Battlestar Galactica. I would have went, oh, shut the fuck up and stop cheating on your spouses, you pieces of shit.
Yeah, there's a fairly similar sort of one, I think, when she comes back from the dead as well.
Yeah, and so I want to know, not from you or I, but you, the younglings out there, I want to hear from you guys, what is it about the romance in Babylon 5 that works for you guys? What's the appeal of it for you? How does this show,
you speaking generally,
pull it off or doesn't for you? Because I know that some of our people listening out there are similar to me, where we have gone through the drudgery that is science fiction TV romances and how they are often handled. And Babylon 5, for all of the praise it gets for being like this great sci-fi opera with these big character arcs.
Yeah.
It's also in the show that it's unabashedly, unflinchingly sentimental and romantic, which I imagine you could squint when you see that being paired with how oftentimes this show is held up by the fans as something where you go, oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? But it is. And sometimes it can be dorky and kind of awkward about it, but it's always been there. It's always been there.
Romance can be like that. So there's this weird element to the romance in Babylon 5, which is that there is a beautiful authenticity to the way that it is present it. And sometimes that works. Like the chaste romance that's evolving but stable between John and Delenn. And then you have lots of people who do not like the Ivanova and Marcus stuff. But there is a vulnerability in authenticity to unrequited attraction or love, which that is exploring. And then you have the what could have been with Ivanova and Talia.
I look at these characters when it comes to romances as defining things for them. Obviously, some of it, like we see here, will be the end of them, right? But I don't look at the implementation of romance to be there for the sake of it, and I don't see it as a stone around the character's neck that drags them down, like I do with, say, I don't know, Major Kira and Odo and Deep Space Nine, where it's not even their specific romantic relationship, but when they have romance in their stories, it's I just want to die, and it feels like whatever I love about those characters is stripped away.
Like Troy Paul.
Oh, yeah, Troy and Riker, sure. No, I know what you meant, Luxana Troy. But she's a one. It's like she's a in and out character. That's fine.
Yeah, but you really like her with
Odo. I like her with Odo more than I ever did Odo and Kira together.
Yeah,
you're right. Look, we're not a Deep Space Nine podcast. We're not going to get into it. But to just go
not a Deep Space franchise.
We actually stand for something. But just to keep going on the romantic side of this, the Ivanova-Marcus relationship definitely has moments to blossom here. Marcus is very, very grounded in this episode. Hence, it really hurts.
Not overly quippy.
He threatens to be overly quippy. He's self-aware.
And I love that it's a weapon.
That's great because it's not only acknowledgement from the character, but the writer that they know that this is an annoying trait, that this is bad, and that it's a weapon that you can use.
Taping it out over time.
Well, let me put it to you this way: you can either get 4 hours and 59 minutes rest, or 4 hours and 59 minutes of me bothering you about it.
You wouldn't.
Rangers never bluff.
Ivanova knows that there's an ambush for the White Star fleet, or for the fleet in general. So she's contemplating taking the White Stars to do it first because they're fast, vulnerable, and they don't want to sacrifice the Earth vessels that they've acquired.
Because they're too important in terms of what they represent.
Exactly. It's about what they represent as well as just vulnerabilities of their ship designs.
It's not about their firing power.
Yeah.
It's about wanting to make sure that they're present when they take on Earth.
And Marcus is concerned for Ivanova throughout the entire episode. Yeah, there's lots of lingering shots. And very quiet. There's lots of shots that just leave it hanging on his face as he watches her assume military role.
He does that anyway, so... And his position kind of encourages that, but the way that Jason Carter expresses that, and the way that it's blocked, so that you don't immediately notice how much he's doing it. I think that's something that you may appreciate more on a rewatch than on the first one. Like, you can tell that he's just like wary of the mode that she's gotten into.
And he has to put on a certain persona as well. He very much comes across as a number one.
Yes.
Like, in terms of positioning as, like, you're my number one officer here. You're my right-hand man. Instead of the early days where he was Mr. I am not in the ranking for you. I'm not in the hierarchy here. I've made something based on the Ottoman Empire. Like, he was always quippy and undermining her and being a dickhead.
Just wanting to make her laugh and smile. And he's still trying to do that in some ways, like when he's threatening her with the quips. But he knows where the line is with her and where to push it and the way to play it so that he gets what he wants.
Yes, but then what really upsets me, all of this is great. Marcus, right up to the very end of the episode, has so many wonderful things. Jason Carter's playing the tragedy and the romance to a T. But there's one piece of direction I've always went, don't do that. Why did you do that? Which is when Ivanova's sleeping on the bed. I'm fine with him saying to himself, you'll never know. That's fine.
The hand?
Oof, creepy. Creepy.
Too far.
Creepy. Weird. Icky. Don't like it. Mm-mm. She's laying there and he just puts his hand over her face and almost strokes her face.
But it's like middle.
Yeah.
Like it's like if it was like a almost cheek.
Yeah. It's a full like, face right down from brow like, to chin. I'm
like
going to
face palm more than a, like a caress.
If I did that to you, I'm married to you. We've been together for almost 11 years.
If I woke up with your palm in front of my face.
And I said quietly, you'll never know.
You would
be very upset.
What the fuck have you done to me?
If I told you I did that to you regularly when you slept. If I said to you, Rachel, by the way, when you sleep sometimes, actually quite often, I'll put my hand over your face and just say something sweet. You wouldn't find that endearing, would you? Would you?
We need to go to counseling.
I mean, maybe somebody finds that endearing, but I don't. It's creepy. It's creepy.
No.
And I don't want
to. I'm unsettled by it.
And I don't want to stick
Absolutely.
On this point for too long because it's not the
no,
intention,
it's
but
it's
it does.
It's a small thing. Like, it's a relatively small thing, as you pointed out, but it is something that taints that scene. It's just like, oh, yeah, he's really sweet. And then she's like almost sort of reciprocal in his feelings. Like she's really warmed up to him and come a long way.
She speaks Mindari now a bit too. So yeah, she's learned that saying.
And like she remembers what he said. So very convenient that she has that kind of memory all of a sudden.
Yeah. All of a sudden, JMS, another one pulling out there. Someone's going to say she's always had that. I don't think so.
I think it definitely should have been brought up when they were discussing like the teleprompter stuff with Voice of the Resistance. I think that would have been a good place to seed it a little bit earlier. Like, I know that she's doing the teleprompter thing, but if she's just like... I'm fine. I read the script. I can remember it. It's fine.
That would have been neat.
That would have been neat. But it is, it's a decision that really takes me out of it.
To just emphasize again, I get annoyed when I engage with material and you clearly know that the intentions are supposed to be good. And it's doing that for 99% of it. Like 99%, yes, 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 I'm in love with this. Jason Carter is beautiful in this performance. He's tearing up. He has these funny moments, these wide-eyed looks, these sly grins. And him and Claudia Christian have really found the chemistry between these two characters. Yes, 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 yes. And then there's just that one thing that makes it all topple apart because it's
like,
just so unfortunate because clearly it's not supposed to have any of this. And
better would the end of that scene be if you didn't have that massive speed bump right before it?
The last time that we were in this room, you said something to me in Minbari. I happen to have an eidetic memory. It went, Nusan Fulani in Alas Midron. You told me it was just a greeting.
Yes.
Well, in case you haven't noticed, I've learned a little Minbari since then. Thank you.
This is a story filled to the brim with so much that you almost forget to even talk about that Earth has an elite special fighter unit
with
where they've
shadow
used
tech.
Shadow technology. That should be a whole episode in itself.
I completely forgot about that thing existing until in the episode they were like, Clark's pretty sure of these forces. And I was like, oh yeah, that.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah. The destroyers that have spider legs at the back of them.
And the skin of the hull.
Yeah.
Of, it, they
but
look
I mainly
cool.
remembered the,
yeah, the spider legs.
The shape.
And, yeah, and they have the little lasers. I love the designs. I
yeah,
love the,
I think
the sounds
really,
that they use for
really
it too.
Really nice melding
but you just,
of the thing.
It just doesn't stick in the brain when it comes to the
it's
back
too
half
quick.
Of season. For something that is, we're fighting against Earth and now Earth has physically joined up with an old foe,
yeah.
That should be memorable.
Again,
that should be memorable.
It's a It's a cost of them being on fast forward.
Yeah, but I... Yeah, and also it's because they wrap him up super easy.
Yeah, like it's...
Oh, not easy, Ryan. Did you see what happened to Ivanova? Yeah, I know. But still, they wipe these guys out pretty quickly, and it seems like they've had like just bigger troubles with normal cruisers.
Oh, one battle. Done. Like, we do get a sense of, like, there's a good amount of white stars. They're there. But we don't get any intel that they have telepaths on board.
Yeah, I don't know if it would even work in this case, right?
Yeah.
Because they still have human crews that radio them. How, yeah, I, this is one of the things that makes the Earth Civil War a little weaker to me, which is the actual Earth fighters we're fighting against rarely, if ever, feel intimidating to me. It's the people on the ships that feel intimidating to me rather than the ship battles.
Yeah.
When we had No Surrender, No Retreat, there's great CGI and great fighting and stuff like that. And there's wonderful heft and stuff. But what was bringing the fear and bringing the tension is when we would cut over to Mackie, not sure if he's going to switch sides. And you cut to Captain Hall and he's frothing at the gills to draw blood. And you cut to Sheridan and he's trying to broker peace. And here... we get Ivanova giving a fantastic monologue, truly one of her best, about how she's going to send them to hell and she is death incarnate and, God sent her. One of the best Ivanova speeches, for sure, but then it just cuts to some CGI stuff where I guess the appeal is, look, guys, new evil ships, and that they are neat, but... this is the only time we see them. This is the only group of them. And we wipe them out really, really quickly.
Yeah. Like, it's a battle that cost them a lot. But because there's so limited time and space to deal with that, it doesn't feel it. It's just like you feel... the personal weight of it, of us potentially losing a character that we really like. And on rewatches, because we know where it's going, we know that Ivanova survives and Marcus sacrifices himself, it feels even more just functional that this happens, because it's just like, oh, well, yeah, Earth did get one of the shadow ships.
Replicate the technology.
So what happens with that? And two, we need to have something happen to one of our main crew, right? Like, they can't all just... get through scot-free.
Especially in this episode where Ivanova was winning time after time after time.
So there needs to be a cost.
Mm.
So, and how are we going to play that out? And it feels very functional in the fact that it is condensed as well of we need Ivanova to get to this point. So it's just like, why is Marcus is relatively fine? And it's just like, the bridge is fucking wrecked.
He was just in a lucky spot, and that's
fine.
It's just
like, I'm also always like, now, like, this is why it makes sense to have extra things around the captain's chair.
But she wasn't near the captain's chair. No. She was right at the nose of it. I didn't mind the incident itself.
No.
Because it is surprising. It is like, a shock. And you are at the edge of your seat going, they're going to hurt Ivanova.
Battle is more what I was
The battle's trying. There. The battle is there so that that does happen. Just like the knife is there so that it can happen to Garibaldi. Yes, this
convenient.
Is...
convenient.
It's not just convenience, but again, that word that we've used, functionality, it's functional, it's serviceable, it does the job, but I'm not walking away from this talking about the shadow hybrid ships, really. Nope. Even though I would in any other context.
Like, oh, that's a thing.
A fun fact is many years ago now, I guested on our friend's podcast, Chats a Television podcast, when they were covering B5. I came on for this episode and none of us brought up these ships. We actually forgot to bring it up because there's so much more to talk about. And we just said, yeah, there was a battle and Ivanova got injured.
Yeah.
And then I emailed them afterwards saying, hey, we didn't even talk about this big aspect of the episode. And then they discussed it in the next one saying, oh, yeah, it was cool and all, but it just doesn't leap out.
No, it's not impactful the way that, like, you kind of said this before. Of, like, you think it would be more impactful when you phrase it as the two big bads
are joined as one and now they're fighting you.
Yeah, and there's a physical representation of that. Like, that idea sounds very cool, very appealing. You get why it was in the Bible.
It's time to get sad now. Ivanova has been critically injured. Mm-hmm. She's on death's door. And
she's got like a week, maybe, she's to lucky. Live with her various injuries.
She's in a brace. She's got many, many things hooked up to her. They've put the bed flat because that's how she likes it. But
Marcus demanded.
Yep. But as stated, the reason that they don't sleep like that is because you're tempting death. And so her being flat is tempting death in just
well,
to
they're
underline
told
it.
That death is coming for her, so.
Yeah, and so it's just another layer to the sadness here because something as simple as Marcus saying that he laid the bed down flat because he didn't know what else to do and he knew she would like it like that. Oh my God, that's one of the things that hits me in the heart the hardest
it's like,
here.
Oh, he knows. He knows her and appreciates what she wants.
And again, that cultural context to why the beds are like that just adds a sadness to mm-hmm. what's happening here. Something as simple as a bed now being flat, making me feel something, is just credit to how JMS
because
has woven and made this world be a living, breathing
thing.
Just
before the battle, she slept on the angle.
She had learned how to sleep on the angle. But we have been in many moments in our lives, you and I, whether together or apart, where there's been something monumental that has happened and you don't know what to do and it's just these weirdly specific things that you do that you feel will help make things better,
like,
or for you to cope. Oh, I didn't know what else to do, so I made the bed flat. I helped.
Yeah, like people often do that with food.
I got the bed just how she likes it, nice and flat. They didn't want to. Thought it was bad luck. Didn't know what else to do.
Can I?
She'll hear you. She has been fading in and out since you brought her aboard.
And clearly this has gotten to Marcus, a guy who everyone he has loved eventually dies, and here it is happening again in front of him, and he can't do anything about it. All he can do is watch it happen, and tears roll down his face. Jason Carter is fucking spectacular here.
Amazing.
In this episode.
Amazing, amazing.
There's a reason why to it as well, which is it's going to make you miss him when he's gone, but boy, does it work. You got me, JMS. You're pulling my heartstrings out here. And again, another statement too is, this is also going to make me miss when Claudia Christian leaves the show and doesn't get to come back until the very final episode. Because she's doing some of the greatest acting work in the show in this episode. With the monologue, with her being the leader of the fleet, to now her dying, her acting in that cast and how she twitches and her eyes and the makeup and all of it.
I really love her, like the tenor of her voice. And I agree, it does make me miss what could have been. But when I stop and think about it, I'm like, they thought that wasn't worth the money. That.
They
didn't think that she was worth keeping.
Well, Rachel, there's like 15 different stories as to why she doesn't come back in season 5, and I can't keep track of which one's the truth anymore.
No, I think it's probably various factors, but I know that
that was
her
one of
pay
it was a money thing. Money's always been involved.
It's just like at this stage, especially pay equity, not a thing. So it's not a shocker.
Especially with a show with like no money.
Yes.
As we mentioned before, just to get back to the scene, it's devastating. Of course it is. We love Ivanova. She's such a strong-willed character. So to see her be torn down like this is, it leaves you sitting there feeling awful. This is an episode, as much as we're giving it some flack, I will not lie to you and say that it doesn't make me feel fucking awful and sad and truly feel the tragedy of it all. This is one of those...
It's heart-wrenching.
This is one of those annoying episodes of B5 where I want to so easily say it's not the greatest because of all of these obvious flaws that I can list
you.
Like,
there's plenty of things that are not great, but then there are some things that are really great.
But then this is also the episode that's probably made me the most sad in a very long time in the show. So it feels weird to also then just list off all of this stuff that I don't like about it, but also this is one of the things I absolutely love about it. It's one of the peaks of emotions for me in the season, definitely. If we just want to narrow it down to the season, yeah, definitely. This is one that I never forget. I never forget Ivanova in this state and her asking John to tell her the truth because no one else will.
And the not what, but where. The button to this scene is just...
Oh, yeah.
Because it feels so right in that moment. It feels right so much for Ivanova. It feels right for John. It feels right for their friendship and their working relationship as well. And it's just working on all of these levels as well as being an interesting lead-in.
It is that time of the show, Rachel. I've wheeled it out. I'm dusting it off. I'm taking the cover off. Yes, it's my DVD copy of Spotlight starring Michael Keaton. Yes, the Keats is in it, or as I call him, old Keaty boy. And I'm turning it on. Oh, it's tuning in. Oh my God, it's Spotlight. Spotlight, the part of the podcast where we talk about an actor or actress that appeared in the episode, big or small role, whether they're a recurring in this series, a minor, a one-off, or even a mainstay. We go over what they did, their performance, any interesting pieces of trivia about the performer, and if we've seen them in anything else before. And today, we are talking about that interrogator, the one that is called just Interrogator. We saw him at the end of the previous episode, and now he is here at the beginning of this one, played by Bruce Gray, which is a perfect name for the character, like for a guy who's playing a character who you imagine their name would be Gray, this very mild-mannered name. He was a Canadian television and film actor, mainly TV, and so I would imagine some of our Canadian listeners and even former guests may be familiar with this performer and material he's been in. But Rachel, what did you think of him here in Babylon 5? And yeah, feel free to include when we saw him at the end of the last episode, because we did talk about briefly with our friend Bartek that he had a different register to asking those same questions. There was a little bit more of a hostility there, but not too much. So what do you think of his performance in Babylon 5?
I really like it. I described it, like, I still think that he's a black hole of humanity. There's just the absence of it, and drawing any humanity that's around him and making it disappear.
I really like him. I really like him. And not only just with what he does, but his look as well, because you can easily tell that this is a character actor, somebody who is hired for certain roles by just, you see his headshot and you go, oh yes, he will play this type of, he'll play this type of character. And he fits that very easily here, but he does have a striking look in terms of he's also a very normal-looking person. Slightly balding, tall, a bit of a hangdog face, but he has these piercing eyes, yet there's still these dull eyes. There's just something about him that has always lingered with me whenever I've watched B5. And that interrogation at the beginning, just the surrealness of it, you can definitely tell that JMS loves stuff like The Prisoner. And yep, this guy could have been in The Prisoner.
Absolutely.
He could have been a number two. He could have been one of those guys very easily, because a lot of those people in The Prisoner weren't always absurd and wacky. Some of them would be very, very low energy, just like this performer here, Bruce Gray. Now, are you familiar with him? Have you seen him in anything in particular?
There are a few things where I'm like, I would have seen you in that. I don't really remember you, but I would have seen you in that. The main one being My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
He is the father of the groom in that, right?
Yep.
Yes, he's the father of the groom in that. And he's in both of them. He's in both My Big Fat Greek Weddings. That I did see. Were you into that movie? That movie was like a phenomenon, like a huge sensation. We would never get a movie like that bank as much as it did.
No, it was so weird. It was so weird, that like cultural moment of My Big Fat Greek Wedding obsession. I watched it and enjoyed it. But I'm like, I can't imagine rewatching it. I think I liked it at the time, but I don't think I rewatched it much.
I'd never left much of...
My mum did.
A thing that many people may not know, other than if you're already here in Australia, but it didn't have a special spark to me because we... Yes, you took the words out of my mouth. We have a certain brand of comedy here, WOG comedy, which is, you know, Mediterranean Greek comedy, and that's existed for ages, and it's always been a thing. And so we've had many movies and shows and stand-up specials involving that, and then eventually it's kind of gone around to Lebanese humor, and it's kind of gone around and around and around. There's a whole rabbit hole you can fall down, but basically, to suffice to say,
fresh in the way that it was in other countries.
Or at least in these movie senses, especially with something like this. And that's a part of the appeal of that movie, is the Greek culture and how you put it in a traditional rom-com setting. But for me, that, and for you and many Australians, I mean, I get it. We've got Effie. You know, we've got Effie. People, have fun looking that one up. Look up Effie. She's fun.
Don't you think I know what people say behind my back? If it's not my body, it's more clothes. If it's no more clothes, it's more hairs. Beauty. It's a curse. And I've got it.
He was in multiple Star Treks.
Yeah, he was in a few Star Treks. Now, he was the same character. He's the same Admiral character in TNG and Deep Space Nine. And it was one of those crossovery ones. And so I can't even really recollect. I would imagine he was one of those marquee type storylines, because that's usually the crossover between TNG and Deep Space Nine in that later part, the season 7 of TNG. He was in Gambit Part 1, which I'm just going to put my hands up. I don't remember him because I hate the Gambit episodes. It's my least favorite two. It's one of my least favorite two-parters TNG ever did. And so, yeah, shoot me in the face because I don't remember it. But, yeah, I don't remember it too well. But He was in other sci-fi as well, like, yes, Enterprise. He was in Enterprise, and he played... he played the founding father of Vulcan philosophy. He was the guy that brought logic and wisdom and all of the Vulcan-y things to them.
Yeah.
So
he made them Vulcan-y instead of just Romulan-y.
Or angry. And so Bruce Gray got to play a very pivotal role in the world of Star Trek.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
That character did originate in... TOS, I know this, but hey, this guy came back. This guy brought the role back in some way, shape, or form in Enterprise. And hey, Enterprise is sadly canon, so we got to accept it. Yes, we got to accept it.
I just want to acknowledge now that this man has done a lot of work.
Sci-fi, a lot of it too.
He did a lot of work. 179 credits.
He was in Starship Troopers. He was the Sky Marshal. He's like the evil dictator in that. That's insane.
Yeah, he's fun in that. And then, like, he's always... He's almost in roles that are too small for him to be that guy.
I agree with you, because he was in Crimson Peak, a movie that I quite enjoy. Yeah. And it makes sense because there were other Canadian actors... TV yes. actors in that, and so it makes a lot of sense, of course, because he was a Canadian actor. He was in Medium. He was in a film I also like, Water for Elephants. He was in an episode of Boston Legal, in the one where Denny Crane is offered the chance to run for president for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
A fantastic episode of Boston Legal.
He was in Spy Hard.
As the president.
RoboCop the series?
Yes, there's a series.
Perry Mason, 5 episodes of Murder, She Wrote.
One of which is during the era where JMS was a writer. Now, he didn't write this episode, but it did star someone from B5. Andreas Katsoulis is in the episode of Murder, She Wrote that this actor is in. So that's just a fun little detail. But he also has a deeper connection to Babylon 5, to JMS and his work. Do you know?
No.
Captain Power. Captain Power was a show that JMS and Larry DiTilio and I do believe the producers of Babylon 5 also worked on. Captain Power is very important to Babylon 5's existence.
Context.
If you didn't have that, we probably wouldn't have this show. All right? JMS met some very important people in the development of Babylon 5 because he worked on Captain Power and did a bang-up job. He played the father of Captain Power. He played the guy who invented the power suits and invented the technology.
Yeah.
And so he's a recurring character in that. And so I had no clue. I had no clue about how he was really a part of a formative step in JMS eventually getting to B5. So to see him even get a small part here,
yeah,
it brings a smile to my face because...
It really illustrates how JMS likes to sort of give back.
Yes, there's a community. There's a community to this. If you ever watch Captain Power, one of the characters in there is basically like a proto Ivanova. It's a character that's almost like Ivanova, but not quite. Because that show's also very, very campy and cheesy. And it's for kids.
Yes.
But she has Ivanova style. But he has that important connection to this. And that's probably why he's here. Because they remembered him and they brought him in. And yeah, he did everything. Charmed. SG-1, Falling Skies, How I Met Your Mother. Now, could we go down the How I Met Your Mother rabbit hole? Because I am not as huge into How I Met Your Mother as you were.
Mm-hmm.
You were always much bigger into it than me.
Yes.
You guys can't see it, but Rachel has a big amount of guilt written all over her face from me saying that and her admitting yes to that. She looks very guilty. Because How I Met Your Mother is a very frustrating show, let's just say that. And I saw his character. He's in 4 episodes across 3 seasons. And he starts out as just businessman. And then he gets a character name, a very abstract character name, Euthers or something. I don't know how to pronounce it. Y-U-T-H-E-R-S.
I scrubbed through all of the episodes that he's in.
Mm-hmm.
He's in 4 total. He has lines in 1.
Mm.
And he's not referred to as Euthers in any of them.
But he is the same character in all of them.
Mm-hmm. He works at, what is it, GHB?
Yeah, Barney's company.
Yeah, Barney's company.
He's like a higher up.
Yeah. He's a senior executive. He's in an episode when Marshall is contemplating quitting and gets graduation goggles, which is like rose-tinted glasses, and he's getting to like have a great time just being in this meeting with Marshall cutting his fingernails.
Hmm.
And that's very silly,
but he has no lines.
That's his first appearance. And then he's in one where Barney's trying to get rid of the ducky tie.
Yes, Barney has a tie covered in rubber duckies.
And I think he might say something.
He does. He says some business talk like, please take this seriously. This is important. Cut to Barney trying to hide his ducky ties. Yeah.
Nobody takes this as seriously as I do.
As he's in a silly pose hiding behind his desk.
Yeah.
So they don't see him from the neck down.
Yeah.
And that's it, right? He appears in other episodes but with no lines of dialogue.
No, in the other one, I think he does. But he gets called Herm.
Maybe that's his first name.
Yeah.
Like Hermes.
But not credited.
A Herman.
As that. And that's when Barney fires him.
Okay, that's important. Because what I was going to get to with this is, when you see something like that on IMDb, you go, okay, here's a show, and he starts out as a character with no name, just businessman. And then he's brought back a few more times and they give him a name and it's the same character, working in the same location, interacting with the same characters. On paper, you would say, that means he got something to do.
No, he doesn't.
They gave him nothing to do. And so I'm infuriated because I was like, Rachel and I, we both watched this. Maybe he'll be someone and I just can't remember. You'll remember, Rachel. And then, no, he's just a guy.
He's just nobody. And then the last episode, he's credited in.
But he didn't make it to the final cut.
But I can't spot him. Because I'm pretty sure he's in the background of a party that they're at. They're at like a black tie event.
So he got his job back then. Rachel, Jimmy, I don't know.
I don't know. I really don't know. It's also like that thing of How I Met Your Mother playing around with time.
Talking about sitcoms, he was not in Scrubs.
Not in Gilmore Girls.
Not in Gilmore. I said sitcom.
No, but that's another one.
Yeah. Was he in Grey's Anatomy, though? He would have been a great doctor.
Didn't see him in that list.
He was quite tall, as were many people who star in B5.
Yeah.
This cast is made up of tall people. And I just want to get this little statement out of the way because I haven't made it and I don't know if I'll ever get the chance. B5 would make certain props and things designed for the very tall cast. Most of this cast are well over 6 foot tall. And so that means when actors who weren't the main cast would come in and have to sit on these things, like the chairs on the Agamemnon, for instance, that's made for Bruce Boxleitner, right? But you would have seen that chair be used in No Surrender, No Retreat by the very small Ken Jenkins, and that's why he looks like a baby sitting in a chair. Because it's not
like
made
a grumpy
for, it's not made for somebody of normal height or smaller. And so you get abundance of people in B5 are surprisingly tall, and so everything is designed for these people who are the regulars or the mainstays or the go-to background actors or supporting cast. And so when you get regular heighted people or shorter people, they look weird interacting with everything. And since we don't get the we don't have the contrast that Sheridan is incredibly tall.
No.
Bruce Boxleitner is 6'3". He's taller than me. He's taller than me, but you wouldn't know that because he's standing next to Jerry Doyle, who's like 6'2", and he's standing next to Franklin, who's like 6'1". Like, you just don't get the idea, like, how and Claudia Christian's tall for a woman, so it's like, you just don't.
Yeah, like,
that's a reason why we don't have Takashima.
The corridors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, wait, how high is that thing?
They're high. And so even this guy is tall. Next to that, his second, the other lady, she's really small in comparison.
Yeah.
But she's probably like a normal heighted woman.
But it does look like her feet aren't touching the ground.
Because the chair was probably made for the other interrogator, it was probably like 8 foot tall.
Or you had to like adjust the level so that they're in frame together.
On our scale of Yum being bad and Yum Yum being good, where does between the Darkness and the Light go? I always struggle with that title because I want to flip it around or just say dark, because there's also Ceremonies of Light and Dark that always muddles me. It's not that I don't remember the title. It's just I get muddled with other titles.
Yeah.
But you said before, right before we recorded, you looked me dead in the eyes and said, oh, this is an easy Yum. Let's go. And I was a bit surprised because to me, I'm struggling with where to land on this. So I want to know.
That was me
still
being sarcastic.
Well, is it an easy Yum, meaning
it's
bad?
It's not an easy one either way. But for me, there's more good than bad, so it's a Yum Yum.
Yum Yum.
I'm going to give it a Yum.
Yum.
It's all over the place tonally. It's wild. It has some of my favorite material, but also it had the worst line.
Oh, yes.
It's also got the worst line JMS
Agreed.
Has ever written in the show. So
I'd agree.
And at this point in season four, especially in between where we are right
this.
Now, not only just that, but from where we were and where we are going next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is just,
it's a slip.
It's sloppy.
I acknowledge that it's sloppy, but it has moments that are so important to me in terms of the show that it felt disingenuous to give it a Yum, even though it has enough faults to qualify as a Yum. But because it has just certain moments, the John and Delenn kiss, the I know
Marcus.
What you said moment with Ivanova and Marcus, the I didn't know what else to do, so I made the bed flat.
Tell me, John, no one else will.
Lita.
Oh, Lita.
Just on the fire. And we only get those moments here. And I love those moments so much that I just couldn't bring myself to give it the Yum that it probably deserves.
And I'm right there with you, but I'm on the opposite end where that line, if it was anyone else other than you, I wouldn't be cool with it, but blah-de-blah. Oh, shut up, JMS. But JMS, please tell us in your DVD description what we'll be watching next time on Babylon 5.
On the next Babylon 5.
Endgame. First Mars, then Earth. Sheridan and his forces, including telepaths modified to become rogue agents.
Spoilers.
Inside the enemy CPUs.
Spoilers.
Begin a methodical plan of attack against President Clark and his Earth Force fighters.
Thank you for spoiling it, DVD description. Real good job there. Not like That would have been nice to experience.
Sorry, there's even more spoilers in the
next one. Of course there is. So that is the episode. That is our discussion of Between the Darkness and the Light. I thank you all so much for giving us your time and your ears. You send them in to us physically, and I don't know what to do with this bucket full of ears, but thank you all so much for your ears and your time. If you want to spend more time with us, you can go back and listen to previous episodes, or you can head over to our Patreon, where we have a whole slew of bonus content, including discussions about The Expanse. We're going through The Expanse episode by episode, and we are watching it for the first ever time. So if you want to join us in that adventure, or you've already experienced The Expanse and you want to hear our thoughts right now on it, you can head over to our Patreon. And there's so much more content on there. You will be filled up for days. If you can, you can also follow us on your social media of choice under Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast. We post on there regularly and we love interacting with you people. We love chatting with you. We even love arguing and debating about whether or not Babylon 5 has capitalism in it, which it does. And it does, and it does critique it. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Now, Rachel, where can people email us?
yumyumpod@gmail.com.
Oh, and should they give us a Yum Yum rating and review?
Yes. You still haven't got any external website to adopt that system, so you just have to go with 5 stars.
Or a thumbs up. If you're watching this on a place that gives a thumbs up, give it a thumbs up. Share the podcast around with all of the people you know or anyone that you think would be interested in hearing two Australians, the only Australian Babylon 5 podcast in the known universe. I don't know about heaven yet. I'm trying to get there. It's difficult to get into heaven. But you know what's also difficult? Finishing a podcast, coming up with an endline catchphrase. But we didn't have to, because JMS wrote a brilliant farewell in
Chicago
The Gathering.
Was finally back again, and I loved everything Jakar was doing.
But I was upset with him because he didn't say good eating to you.